PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Matthew Witt. Matt is University of Laverne Professor of Public Administration. He's a leading scholar of state crimes against democracy. They undermine America's legitimacy and founding doctrine, and Matt explains it very well. Matt is also a valued contributor to a forthcoming book I hope will be out about around mid-year, an important book. I think it will be the definitive book on the topic, and it's titled Flashpoint in Ukraine, U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. Indeed it does. And again, I repeat, Matt is a valued contributor to the book. Hopefully it'll be out. I wish it could come out today because Ukraine is hot and I keep writing daily articles about it. There's so much going on. I'm working on another one for tomorrow. Outrageous stuff that people need to know about. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Stephen. Always a pleasure.
Oh, it's great to have you on. Shall we jump into Ukraine to get your latest comments? I'll mention this. It's like a daily soap opera, Matt. I mean, I keep thinking I'm going to run out of topics, but I've literally written daily articles, since way back around the middle of February, and I think there was only one day in that entire sequence that I didn't write an article on Ukraine. I think I've got enough to fill two books. When I checked the latest news at the beginning of the day, I see stuff that's brand new, and you got to go to the next chapter. And the next chapter is ongoing. You get activists in eastern Ukraine that are rebelling against the Kiev putschists, who have no legitimacy whatsoever. They're fascists. A bunch of them are neo-Nazis. They openly display Nazis insignia, SS insignia, swastikas, Iron Cross. They walk around with this stuff in public. They use Nazi salutes. And these are Obama's new friends, as I like to call them, Matt.
It's astounding. Stephen, it's just astounding. One always wonders when the hypocrisy will catch up to the echo chambers in Washington, D.C., but it's a remarkably hermetic place, as you know, and any of us who try to keep tabs on it. In this instance, of course, the heralding of the arrival or the restoration of so-called democracy with the putsch in Kiev on the one hand, and then the denouncing of activism in eastern precincts on the other hand. It's I guess to be expected, but always somehow disappointing that these beguiling initiatives don't get called out. Otherwise, I was watching the news hour the other day to see how they were giving account of Kiev, and I was startled in a number of ways, one of which is how blatant and brazen is the advertising for military industrial contractor BAE, a long infomercial for that firm.
On a commercial-free broadcast, Matt.
On a commercial-free broadcast. Incidentally, when I was looking up to get the transcript of the exchange between Judy Woodruff and correspondent Margaret Warner, I believe it is.
Yes, yes.
I found news about the news hour that, in fact, has been privately owned now since the early 90s. If you can believe it, by a very right-wing media mogul. I'll look up to find his name again.
Well, I didn't know that. But,
yeah, it's been privately owned for quite some time. And it just, we're not talking about the news hour here, but a along the lines of, you know, channels that have been bestowed, you know, above the fray legitimacy, in among media critics in the U.S., the NewsHour is second to none. And here we have one that is not only privately owned by a very conservative billionaire, but, you know, fronts for Council on Foreign Relations regularly. Its supporters are the usual suspects of launderers for State Department and CIA operations. It's just astounding, you know, that this entity has been heralded for so long, reputed for so long to be, you know, measured and above the fray. But its account, in this case, of Ukraine was talking points literally right out of State Department. They were using references and language that a speechwriter for Kerry could have written. And it struck me, it was so startling how this was so like Fox News, you know, laundered to sound right, more legitimate for the educated upper middle class. But the talking points were exactly the same. It's just the volume and the vehemence were toned down a bit. But the omission of the suspicions about utilization of Greystone, offshoot of Blackwater, and the mercenaries who were reputed to have been very involved in Kiev, now evident in Donetsk and Kharkiv and Lugansk,
yes,
and eastern Ukraine. But then, of course, you have Kerry preempting any accusations by saying himself, we're pretty certain that Moscow has dispatched special forces into those areas to fuel unrest. So you have this mirroring going on, where on the one hand, whatever happened in Kiev, the Western press reputes to be restoration of democracy and you know, economic stability is on its way as soon as IMF protocols are fully adopted. But in the East, we have unrest, chaos, evidence of insurgent activity. We don't have occupiers who have an interest in sovereignty and ethnic recognition. What we have are looters and hostage takers, and so on.
Oh, the lies just repeat. They just repeat, Matt. And it typically, the New York Times, which certainly is the most prominent worldwide publication, its feature stories circulate worldwide. And the New York Times, in an article, Ukraine article I'm working on for tomorrow, a very short article. They just put out some brief information on some of the things going on in eastern Ukraine. And here's a couple of quotes from the New York Times, you know, the premier publication, all the news that's fit to print and all that rubbish. And they call the courageous activists in eastern Ukraine, they call them an unruly Russian-speaking club-bearing crowd. And then, the activists who proclaim the Donetsk People's Republic, courageous people who reject fascism in Kiev and they want democratic rights. And the Times calls this group a quixotic and crackpot project, quote unquote. New York Times.
Was that an op-ed piece?
No, that came out of an article by one of their correspondents. It's on the New York Times website today.
Was a correspondent quoting some official with that loaded language, crackpot and quixotic?
No, I was quoting the New York Times correspondent.
That's remarkable. I mean, that's so over the line.
It really is.
Editorializing on an otherwise news piece.
Oh, indeed. I mean, when a correspondent's crossed the line into opinion, they're no longer correspondents, but you get to the editorial page. Oh, it's just as awful. And Washington Post, I'm quoting garbage from the Washington Post. I've done it many, many times. It's a neocon publication now connected to the CIA, Matt. Jeff Bezos, the Amazon guy who bought the Washington Post for $300 million, he has a $600 million contract with the CIA. So he is locked at the hip with the CIA and its policies, and he got $600 million. He got double his money back. He gets a free newspaper and $300 million, something like that. But he's basically a CIA asset, some journalism.
Never mind all that money. He gets his newspaper free every day? It's astounding. I didn't know that about Bezos. That's wow.
Oh yeah, in fact, the Washington Post even admitted they wrote about it at the time. I mean, it was a feature story. I mean, it really was a big story. I mean, the Washington Post sells to a new owner. How could the Washington Post not mention that? So they mentioned him. I forget exactly the way they wrote up the story, but they covered it, and lots of other media establishments covered it as well. I think they downplayed this. I'm not certain if they mentioned the CIA connections, but media critic Robert McChesney really lit into them for this, and I quoted him at length, just denouncing the notion that an American media publication would join at the hip with the CIA. I mean, talk about losing credibility. I can't imagine a better way to lose it.
What is the definition of credit? What is the operational definition of credibility at this point? It's moved so far towards fascism, Stephen, in this country. When you say credibility, when I say credibility, it means something very different from what John Kerry claims to be credible evidence, or what Jeff Bezos or what Washington Post claims to be credible. And it's all so incredible, really. I guess that's, among other things, what I'm working on and what I try to contribute to your voluminous work. I don't know how you keep up on all this, but along with others in this, what in your introduction you refer to as the SCAD research, State Crimes Against Democracy research, I'm trying to formulate some thoughts around what, I'm calling what only academics could love, discourses of beguilement. And, whether it's the Lehrer NewsHour, stylized as if above the fray, or the Washington Post, or the New York Times, or any number of other organs of the neoliberalized state, that what the public presumes to be, measured and informed and grounded, dispatches from abroad are in fact laundered. They're shaped, they're groomed, they're predetermined. There is no breaking news, It's just, the next rollout for a narrative that is intended to bewitch and beguile the public. And it's not as if to pretend I'm the guy or we're the guys that discovered this at all, but it seems to me that as I look back my time here on the planet, that the gear ratios have accelerated dramatically in this regard, and that we have since 1989, we have a propaganda machine on steroids, almost feverish with its fervor over world domination and trying to determine a storyline that's plausible for the American public, Anyway.
truth is turned on its head, one of my favorite expressions, Matt, and misinformation substitutes telling people what they need to know about the most important issues, and it really astounds me. I think it's very easy to research this and make a slam dunk case that if you go back in the post-World War II era, you could look at the U.S. presidencies, and following Roosevelt, succeeding presidents were worse than the ones they followed. Truman, not as good as Roosevelt. Maybe Eisenhower, not as good as Truman. Well, an exception, I think, was Jack Kennedy. I think Jack Kennedy broke the mold, but we know what happened to him. He went against the grain, went against the system, and the biggest sin he committed was really a changing in midstream from Cold Warrior to Peacemaker. It's amazing transformation for him. He came into office literally as a Cold Warrior. He sent more troops to Vietnam at the beginning, and he realized he made a terrible mistake. And I remember quoting him in an article, in a conversation he had with one of his aides, one of his key advisors. Oh, I forget who it was. I know the name so well, and I can't think of who it was. But he was adamant, and apparently the guy was really urging him to send more troops to Southeast Asia, including Laos. And he made a very strong comment back, something to the effect, I'm telling you, I'm telling you, I absolutely want no more forces sent to this part of the world. In other words, he was aggravated by what this guy was telling him. He was surrounded by people who wanted more war, not less. Not all of them, but a good many of them. And he just went in the opposite direction. And he issued an order, I think, to take effect months after he was assassinated, that he wanted 1,000 troops out of Vietnam. And within a year from then, he wanted them all out of Vietnam. And I think that was the main reason he was killed.
Yeah. I think there's a good case to be made that Kennedy should be canonized by the Catholic Church. I mean, I realize that sounds sort of, you know, bizarre, but what you characterize is really, I think, the definitive American tragedy, if anyone ever gets around to writing one about us, that this was the one moment that we had a real leader step up, probably the first full, you know, epic leader since Abraham Lincoln. Roosevelt played his part, certainly, to flip the narrative about what would be the social contract that would be legitimated in the United States. He played a huge role in that regard. But in terms of raw leadership, I think that there wasn't much between Lincoln and Kennedy in terms of taking real, you know, moral risks for themselves, and we know what happened. But I hear you completely about Kennedy and the decline since. There is this premise that we have at this point, presidents who are essentially hostages to the national security apparatus. And I think you and I exchanged some on this at some point as I was preparing this Ukraine piece. Maybe I mistake for others that I'm corresponding with, Stephen. But there's this, Robert Perry writes that he wonders if Obama in some ways fits this mold of hostage. And I don't know how far we want to talk about that, because it seems to me an overwhelming evidence that Obama is fully immersed in neocon agenda, and that whatever was made about his so-called team of rivals was more pretension and effort to get prestige transference upon him from Lincoln than anything really genuine. But Perry raises the point that Obama has benefited tremendously from some of Putin's initiatives, including giving him cover for scaling back in Syria. The threats that Kerry was making overtly in Syria, perhaps off script and off leash, as far as Obama was concerned, as well as the Snowden affair, that Putin giving refuge to Snowden spared Obama a very embarrassing rapprochement with that individual that would have cast a pall upon him from his left support what's left of it in the U.S., that he would have to square accounts with Snowden publicly with something that Putin spared him. Now, I think that that's maybe, I think that's a fairly thin thread to develop a narrative that Obama is hostage to neocons that have taken over his foreign policy agenda, because there's overwhelming indication otherwise that he's fully in support, essentially, of their agenda. But it may be interesting in the context of what you say about American presidents. I think also of Victoria Nuland, Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, and her demonstrably unstateswoman-like comments, you know, about what she said about the European Union when it was, you know, respectful of Yanukovych's concerns about joining and what it would mean for Ukraine, and in her tapped phone discussion, almost certainly by Russians, that got released on YouTube with Ambassador to Ukraine. Name escapes me at the moment.
Piet was his name. I forget his first. I think it was Jeffrey Piet. P-Y-A-T-T.
But you know, yeah, the scandalous remarks that Nuland made, that doesn't sound like about the European Union. I don't think I can use the words on air. But that doesn't sound like something that Obama would authorize. No drama Obama, I don't think, would authorize that kind of way, way off the leash kind of remarks. But Victoria Nuland, of course, has not only married to the neocon through her husband, but, you know, deep connections into the military brass through brother Robert Kagan.
Yes.
To her husband. And, you know, so, but to what extent we have a president otherwise hostage who would wish for more judicious foreign policy, finesse the matter with the sovereign head of state of Russia in a parallel fashion, perhaps, to Kennedy and Khrushchev, nothing maybe quite so sincere or genuine or, you know, epochal. But perhaps analogous, that, you know, from where those individuals sit at the very top, they see more clearly the danger of brinkmanship, that operatives below them otherwise are frothing at the mouth to see occur. So we had the counterparts to our strange Lovian hawks that Kennedy had to deal with. You know, Khrushchev had his counterparts as well, almost certainly to some extent, not to the same extent, but to some extent. So similarly, perhaps Putin and Obama are signaling one another, as Khrushchev and Kennedy did through back channels,
could
to
be.
Try and develop some alternative scenario. I don't. Robert Perry finds this plausible. I'm not so sure. I bring it up in the context of your point about what's happened to our president since Kennedy. Don't know.
Matt, I would say this. I absolutely would say Obama is hostage to nobody. He's a hostage.
Okay.
He's no hostage. The way the system works is very clear,
yep.
And you can research this and you can find it out. Nobody
yep.
gets to a high position in America, especially the presidency, but the chairmanships
yep.
of important committees, the key positions in Congress, the key bureaucratic positions, unless they're very carefully vetted to check
yep.
that they're with the system, they're with the power structure. And Kennedy... Kennedy was vetted. I mean, he had a lot
sure.
of his daddy's money, but he was vetted, and he was part of the
sure.
system when he was picked to be the Democrat candidate. He changed after he was elected. He never would have been picked had he been the Kennedy he became, as opposed to
no.
the Kennedy he was before he was
yep.
elected. But they're all vetted
yep.
in advance, and with Obama,
sure.
it went back to Columbia University, to college, and through law school, and he was picked as a comer, and they knew very, very well what kind of guy this this was, and they groomed him for something.
Sure.
And of course, we see what he was, the position he was put into, and the idea. And if you checked his voting record as an Illinois state senator and as a U.S. senator, and take out the name Obama, well, he was as much Republican, or even more so, as most Republicans. He did not vote like a Democrat. He voted like a Republican. He was an anti-populist all the way. He was militant. Yeah. He was on the wrong side of the big issues, and this is the reason they picked him. And of course, he was a good blackface, a good choice to be America's first black president. Yeah, he's big deal. Who cares what color his skin is? It's what his policies that matter, and his policies are absolutely hugely destructive. I've had a couple of web editors who wouldn't post for me because I was honest about Obama, and they wanted to believe that he was different from Republicans.
Sure.
So they would bash Republicans, Matt, but they wanted to give Obama a pass. Well, forget Republican, Democrat. Look at agendas and judge them on their own value, their own merit.
Yeah. I hear you, Stephen. I raised the point not because I find it entirely credible, but because, you know, in the context of American presidencies since Kennedy, the idea that, you know, certainly they weren't idiots, they would understand that, you know, they're hemmed in dramatically by the agenda, by the NSA, by the CIA, State Department, and its turnstile into all of these, you know, secretive clubhouses of the elite that go way back. But nonetheless, that looking at the world from the position of, you know, straddling the top, would they wonder, you know, how many degrees of freedom do they have and their place, their posterity, you know, if for nothing else than their egos and their libraries, to glimpse some kind of possibility for initiative they could take, more statesmanlike than a foregone conclusion.
Oh, indeed.
It'd be nice, right? It'd be nice to have another Kennedy.
Well,
what are the odds?
Well, they got rid of the one I don't know that you want to go into politics, but Ted Kennedy Jr., the one who died in a plane crash?
John Kennedy.
Oh, John Kennedy. I'm sorry. John Kennedy Jr. The spitting image of his father.
Spitting image. He had ambitions. He had a platform through his publication, and in a somewhat mysterious, if not very mysterious, incident, crashed.
Well, I think he was murdered. He was murdered.
Well, it seems very. I mean, who would again? Right? When a figure like that dies, you look at the cui bono beneficiaries.
Absolutely. Same thing with Senator Paul Wellstone.
Of course, Wellstone. Yeah.
The thing on him, I wrote about him some time ago, and it was rumored that he had some very, very disturbing stuff about Senior Bush. And it was during his campaign, and his plane went down mysteriously. Well, he was murdered. I'm sure that John Kennedy Jr. was murdered to get rid of these people, the ones who would be outliers against the system. But that would have been something. If John was literally a possible reincarnation of his father and really had the gumption to pursue the agenda his father did, well, my goodness, even to get a few good years would have been remarkable. And I always wondered, Matt, what difference would it have made had Jack Kennedy had two full terms and left the White House in January 1969? Well, the Vietnam War wouldn't have cranked up in the mid-1960s. It would have been entirely different. And Kennedy, I'm not certain whether he was as much on the side of Johnson's Great Society, but I think he was moving in that direction. He was the first president who endorsed using food stamps. I think there was something earlier than him, but he was the first one with a significant initiative for an agenda like that, a social agenda. And he was really a conservative guy. So maybe he was moving in that direction. So we could have gotten social benefits. We could have gotten anti-war policies. He supported Palestinian rights. He wanted all nuclear weapons, total nuclear disarmament. Can you imagine an agenda like that? He wanted rapprochement with the Soviet Union. One group great policy after another. He ordered the Treasury to begin producing Treasury notes as opposed to Wall Street-owned Federal Reserve notes. There's no real clear cue as to whether he wanted to go wholeheartedly in that direction, but it was a wonderful start, and the idea that he might have considered dumping the Wall Street-owned Federal Reserve to put money power back where it belongs, in public hands, not in private hands. Oh, my God, potentially what we lost by losing this guy, Matt.
And not perhaps just potentially, but very, very actually, Stephen, if I follow your point. I think he would have been, and this is instructive and I think brings us full circle, the Kennedy's vision, articulated in the American University speech, clear signal to the powers that the dark forces that be that he had to deal with. That clearly established a international covenant that was so far from anything Lyndon Johnson ever said or ever would have articulated, and doing so put in place in context reforms that he would have almost certainly implemented domestically had he survived. And whereas the Great Society, ambitious and profound as much of it was, although hasty and, you know, way ahead of product, because of the egomania of Lyndon Johnson in large part, those initiatives would have had a full context, you know, the context that Martin Luther King helped establish, the context that Kennedy helped establish. And we would have had something resonant in this country that would have been truly transformative. And, of course, you know, primordially deeply threatening to the powers that be, deeply, deeply revolutionary and threatening. And to be legitimated and authenticated by the president of the United States, well, that would have been, you know, that would have been truly the end of history, as it were. But not to have been, and I'm thinking now of our current circumstances. Again, energy profits are very much the context determining what's happening in Ukraine. The U.S. Shale fracking industry stands to gain an extraordinary windfall if Russian gas to Europe can be cut off or otherwise made problematic, continuous. And so we can get a sense for that matter on our domestic front. What is going to happen with regard to shale fracking and the agenda and how it will roll out here by better understanding what's going on in Ukraine and Europe, in the Eastern Mediterranean, where the discoveries of vast fields of gas in the Mediterranean Sea, also in the South China Sea, gas reserves there. And so we're seeing, you know, I think the next chapter of global energy hegemony beginning to take clear shape and, you know, bubbling to the surface, as it were, of our politics. You're familiar, of course, with the excellent documentary work, Gasland, accounting for what's happening with shale fracking. Is in that instance a case study of Pennsylvania, I think, in particular. But now we have shale fracking going on in many states in the country. Lines are being formed here, battle lines with environmentalists in California, and it'll be interesting to see how the governor here, Governor Brown, you know, makes way for shale fracking industry and what kind of resistance, if any, his office puts up.
It's a hideous technology, Matt, and it really has yet to prove itself. And my understanding is that a couple of the major oil companies are finding that doing this is unprofitable, and they're dropping out of it. There's an awful lot of gas around besides getting it from fracking, huge amounts of gas. And I think America has a good supply, a lot offshore. You've got a number of countries around the world. The number two countries in terms of known reserves of natural gas are Russia number one and Iran number two. And there are huge areas in Iran or potentially enormous deposits. And it's possible that Iran could end up the number one supplier of natural gas. And when it comes to oil, Venezuela, far and away, has the world's largest reserves. You never hear much about that. But the U.S. Department of Energy acknowledges it. Most of it is in so-called heavy oil, but it amounts to over a trillion barrels. And I remember an article I wrote about it, an early article that I wrote, saying, I think the number was 1.3 trillion. Taking the number right from the Department of Energy website, and I think the title of my article was something like, Venezuela has 1.3 trillion barrels of oil, and I was just swamped with emails telling me I'm crazy, absolutely crazy. Well, I just gave quick answers, saying, oh, go to the Department of Energy website. This was probably around 2006 or so that I wrote this article, and I'm sure whatever was there is updated now. I don't know what it says now, but it said it then, and I just took it verbatim off their site, but I know Venezuela is just loaded with oil, and that's one of the main reasons America wants to get its dirty hands on it to exploit it. Heavy oil, more expensive to refine, but nonetheless oil, and the higher the price the oil goes, Matt, the less troublesome refining this heavy oil is. But again, huge deposits. There's plenty of oil around. We're not going to run out of oil anytime soon, and we're sure not going to run out of gas. And I mean, they could dump fracking all together, and there'd be tons of gas around. I don't know why they mess with it. I mean, they're destroying the environment by doing it.
This is a low-hanging question that I have, for that matter also, Stephen, is given, you certainly, Venezuela, massive reserves, and of course it made Chavez so problematic because the extraordinary power he had proportional to all of that gas within his sovereign territory, all that energy, the oil in particular in his sovereign territory. Of course, we know what happened to Chavez. He had to go. And because that guy was the preeminent populist leader of our time. And this just wasn't going to be stable for Washington, D.C. But for that matter, why the rampage for fracking? Why the Keystone? Why the tar sands? I've been trying to figure that out, given the extent of resource available otherwise. Why, especially with how controversial it's going to be in the U.S. and with standard of living expectations, even conservatives in this country can be made to swing against shale fracking. I mean, even conservatives, because Americans have, you know, still by far the highest standard of living in the world and the highest expectations for environmental quality. The Republican, Democrat alike, there's a huge swing voting block there, tilting in favor of environmental protection. And so I wonder why, when that toxic flammable water bubbles up in Wyoming and North Dakota, you're gonna potentially alienate significant congressional membership as a result. So I'm trying to figure out why they would do this. Yeah, it doesn't entirely make sense, except if this industry believes or is in a big hurry, given the Ukraine flashpoint, to position itself for European demand, winter of 2015. I'm trying to get my head around that too. I think it's very significant for American environmental activism to understand this larger geopolitical grand chessboard, as it were. But if fracking continues, we will destroy aquifers across the continent. And that's cataclysmic. You know, we'll never get those cleaned up again. And so I'm trying to, you know, water is going to be the 21st century precious resource, almost certainly. And so to taint, you know, massive, reservoirs, underground reservoirs with toxins just doesn't add up. At least from what I can see. So, you know, there's a question.
Oh, indeed so. It's astonishing that we're literally destroying, you know, it's almost like burning down your own home, Matt. Destroying the environment
really
that you
is.
Live in. You can
really
only
is.
Get away with this for so long, and eventually it catches up to you. If the water is too poisoned to drink, if the food is inedible, if all of these things happen, then planet Earth becomes uninhabitable. This is what they're doing, and they seem to forget, you know, make a buck today, let somebody else worry about tomorrow. They forget that they live here, and their kids live here, and their grandkids live here, and they don't give a damn.
Unless they know something we don't, Stephen, about populating another planet in a big hurry, it would seem this is madness on steroids. It would seem this is this quest for more and more extraction of carbon and poisoning of the environment. I mean, we're moving into a new phase with shale fracking, which is almost certainly just going to gain momentum. Whether we need the energy or not, it's going to gain momentum. But this is a new phase. Pumping for oil, it presented environmental problems, unquestionably, especially with spills, tanker spills and gushers, like what happened in the Gulf. I mean, unquestionably, huge environmental exposure. But fracking is an order of magnitude very distinctively different. Every time we frack, there's contamination. It wasn't the case with drilling for oil, that every time we drill, there was contamination. Every time we frack, there's contamination on a massive scale. And it's extraordinary. I know you wanted to talk about Israel and what's going on.
It's a big issue for me. It's a major, major issue. Palestinian-Israeli peace talks, a big issue. Most people don't realize, have no idea of the history of Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. And I mentioned it briefly on another program. They really go back to 1949. They really weren't peace talks back then, but Israel became Israel in May 1948. The Israel's so-called War of Independence began in 1947. It ended in May 1948. Massive ethnic cleansing, massive slaughter of Palestinian people. People displaced from their homes, never allowed back. Palestinian villages destroyed. Just horrors, absolute horrors. Gross crimes of war and against humanity. And things have continued until this day, where every single day, Matt, and I write about this, and I follow the events that are happening, and various rounds of peace talks, multiple acts of Israeli violence continue throughout all of this. On a typical day in Palestine, there must be, my goodness, just community incursions pre-dawn, belligerently, violently breaking into homes by Israeli soldiers and other security forces. They must go on an average of something like 6 or 7 or 8 times every single day of the week, 7 days a week. You never hear anything about this. You never get it reported in the major media. Not a word about this. And innocent civilians are targeted. They're arrested. Kids are arrested. I wrote about a young child. I think he was 8 or 9 years old. He was arrested. Typically, Israel doesn't arrest kids younger than around 12, but they treat them like adults. 12-year-old kids. They isolate them from their parents. They interrogate them brutally. They threaten them. They threaten them with rape, with beatings, with other assaults. I mean, these kids are absolutely terrified out of their minds. Imagine it going on with somebody that age. But the notion that multiple rounds of peace talks going way back to 1949, that one was sponsored by the UN in Lausanne, Switzerland, with a very sensible recommendation for the way to solve the problem somewhat equitably for both sides, and Israel wouldn't even listen to it, just turned it down, flat down, wouldn't even discuss it, and then really nothing much happened until the first intifada in the 1980s, and that led to the so-called 1991 Madrid Conference, where really the duplicity on the part of Palestinians began, where the people representing Palestine were literally conspiring against their own people. The negotiations led to Oslo 1993, and the great late Edward Said, the American Palestinian, a Christian, not a Muslim, as a matter of fact, professor at Columbia University. Of all the people, Matt, I've never had on my program that I wish I could have, because he died before I ever had a program, it was Edward Said. What a marvelous guest he would have been. You agree, I'm sure. Oh, he would have been absolutely phenomenal. I think we could have become good friends. He was threatened at Columbia. I think once his office was firebombed because of his position. But he called the Oslo Agreement a Palestinian Versailles, unconditional surrender. He was invited to attend the White House lawn ceremony. He wanted no part of it. He wouldn't go. And he was in direct contact with Yasser Arafat and other Israeli, other Palestinian officials. And he explained to them, I mean, you can't do this. You're sacrificing the rights of your own people. And Arafat was in Tunis at the time. He was expelled after he got out to save his life after the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon. He got out. He was in Tunis. And I called the Oslo Agreement his get-out-of-Tunis free pass. He wanted to come home. He wanted to be the boss in Palestine. And he sold out his own people to do it. So Israel murdered Arafat. They poisoned him. There's no question about that. The evidence is overwhelming. But don't cheer Yasser Arafat. He might have been a noble figure at the beginning, but he changed. He wanted peace, but he also wanted things that would benefit him, and he sold out his people to get them. And as it ended up, he got nothing but Israeli poison, and Palestinians are worse off today than they've ever been. And the current talks going on now reflect an utter sham, and yet they go on anyway. And the latest word, Matt, is that they're probably going to be extended. There was an April 29th cutoff date. They began last July. What's been accomplished? Zero. Zero. And the word is that Abbas, Mahmoud Abbas, the fraudulent Palestinian president, his term expired in January 2009. He refuses to call new elections, and he's going to extend the talks for what, Matt, I ask? For what? There'll be nothing accomplished.
That's a tour de force summary, Stephen. You mentioned Said, his work, Orientalism.
Oh, yes.
I forget the subtitle, and it's one of the most remarkable.
Oh, I read it. Yes.
Scholarship I've ever read. He's an astounding scholar with remarkably penetrating insights into how the West has contrived the East to be an object of fetishization, objectification, and subjugation.
His writings were so deep, and his grasp. I think he was an expert on comparative literature. He would quote all kinds of important figures. Some I didn't know, and they would come one after another.
Yeah.
Just remarkable.
Yeah.
He'd pull out the right thing from the right person and put it in the context of what he was writing about. Extraordinary man.
Yeah, it's really, really, really astounding guy. I wanted to ask your opinion about, the recent exchange between Secretary of State John Kerry and Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman. The State Department I think it was this week, maybe it was even just yesterday. Kerry's posture, I want to get a sense from your thinking. I'm wondering if remarks he makes and the indignation that Israel expresses. You know, they say Israel commented that it was deeply disappointed by Kerry's remarks that appear, I'm reading from New York Times now, that appeared to lay primary blame on Israel for the crisis in the American brokered Middle East peace talks. Kerry dismisses that, saying that he places blame equivalently with Palestinian authorities and Israel. But the New York Times plays up this as if there's this rift, as if there's as if the U.S. is leaning hard, you know, on Israel for its continuation of settlement developments, housing developments in the West Bank. And I wonder, my thinking is that this is all scripted. This is all to appear as if the U.S. against, you know, criticism that AIPAC is governing Washington. You know, that the U.S. has integrity in these discussions, that it's willing to stand up, as it were, to Israel and its hardline policies. And that this is mock outrage or mock concern coming from Kerry. It's all scripted. And that Israel is similarly in on this, that there's this pretension that there's any kind of real, you know, sort of pressure from Washington on Israel, when in fact there is nothing. It just permits bringing to the surface the Israeli position and firming it up. And I'm wondering what you think. Is Kerry on his own, as with Syria, as with Israel? Is the man, the megalomania that he's reputed to be, and calling his own shots? Or is he just deep cover for the same old agenda and just very scripted in this pretense, this drama of any kind of dissent or any kind of standing up to Israel's hardline?
I think it is all prescripted, Matt, with very little wiggle room. You know, over a longer period of time, policy can change a little bit. In the past, Obama and Netanyahu did not particularly like each other, to say the least. And Obama was caught on an open microphone that he didn't know was on, making some less than friendly remarks about Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister. So there can be some very ill feelings. But I think the U.S.-Israeli policy is really locked in stone. And when Kerry was a U.S. senator, he was known as the most pro-Israeli senator in the U.S. Senate. So I think that tells you about John Kerry. So you could have these surface remarks that say one thing, but beneath the surface, you got the hard rock policies where America is in lockstep with Israel and Palestinian rights simply don't matter. And if they did, Matt, my God, go back to 1948 to the present. What on earth have Palestinians gotten? They've gotten absolutely nothing, and I make no bones about it. They're worse off today than they've ever been before. I mean, just the settler population. When Oslo was consummated in September 1993, and I remember it so well. I watched the ceremony from a hotel room. I was at a function that I was hosting, and it was before it got underway. I think it was in the morning. Maybe around midday, but it was before the evening when the main ceremony that I was involved in would be taking place. And I was in my hotel room, and I knew this would be taking place, and I turned on television, and I watched the ceremony. It was a sickening display. Rabin, the Israeli prime minister, he just scowled, shaking hands with Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat was beaming from ear to ear, but it didn't really belie his sellout to his own people. And Bill Clinton, I mean this maestro of Palestinian misery in the middle, Bill Clinton, an unindicted war criminal. We could have a whole program on that. But Kerry, just absolutely pro-Israeli, and a terrible thing. But the point I wanted to make was, in 1993, the settler population was something like 200,000. Today, it's around 650,000, more than tripled in a little over 20 years. It shows you what's happening. It's all on stolen Palestinian land. And literally, they talk about dunams as opposed to acres in Palestine. And literally, on a daily basis, more dunams keep getting stolen. And Palestinians will end up, as I like to say, what Israel wants, on isolated Bantu stands, in isolated Bantu stands on worthless scrub land. Israel wants all all the valued resources. It wants all the valued parts of what it calls Judea and Samaria, and it wants Palestinians having nothing. And America is in lockstep with this policy. And anybody who thinks otherwise, just look at the history of what's happened from Oslo to today. It speaks for itself, Matt.
Is the policy of tension in play here? You know, to constantly create pretexts for terror, to constantly determine a destabilized region, to constantly foment the insurgency and then the, you know, the imperial response. Is it, and again, following the money, our military industrial money is, I mean, it's our lead export at this point.
Matt, you hit on a very, very important point. That's exactly what the strategy is. U.S. strategy, Israeli strategy. Before this so-called cast-led war, this late December 2008, January 2009, Hamas in Gaza unilaterally declared a ceasefire, no attacks on Israel. It lasted over a six-month period preceding that war. Israel launched terror attacks on Gaza multiple times, and finally, after months and months of this, Hamas responded modestly. Israel declared a terrorist attack, and the Gaza war followed. 23 days of absolute mass slaughter and destruction, 1,400 Palestinians murdered, all kinds of civilian infrastructure destroyed, and we have the situation in Gaza today. But that's exactly what Israel does. It provokes something to happen. It blames Palestinians for its crimes, and then it does whatever it wants, individual bombing raids or a war like cast-led, or the Lebanon war in July 2006, displaced one-third of Lebanon's population, killed over 1,000 Lebanese. Same kind of war, targeting civilians, destroying vital infrastructure. This is Israel's dirty game. This is America's dirty games. You could just call it a false flag diplomacy, Matt. I think that's the best way to describe it.
Yeah. All very much key to the beachhead of energy and transit of that energy and in the region.
Oh, sure, in a region that is so rich in energy, and Washington wants all of it, and Israel wants its share, including in offshore waters that belong to Palestinians. We're just about at the end of the program. I don't hear the music. I don't hear the band playing. I need to hear the band playing to know that I need to wrap things up. Conductor, please.
Where's the pit orchestra when you need it?
Oh, indeed. Well, maybe he was on a coffee break. Matt, I thank you so much for coming on. I get so wrapped up in this, I could keep going and not stop. I look forward to getting you back. Many, many thanks.
Likewise. Thank you.
Thank you, Dad. Join us again. We'll be pre-recording on Friday. We'll be live on Sundays at noon at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.